Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by our friends at AudiophileUSA.com. The bestest, most glorious used records online, all excellent and near mint, no guessing on condition when you buy from AudiophileUSA.com. Go there now, search, dig, and load up the cart with gorgeous vinyl records at AudiophileUSA.com. And we're also brought to you by the Groove Washer Record Cleaner. Groove Washer is the best bang for the record cleaning buck. Vinyl cleaning kits start at just $20, and they have bundles as well as Groove Guard record sleeves. The best protection for your record collection, that's groovewasher.com. Discount code VINYLGUIDE10. And with that, on with the show. Well, hey everyone, welcome to episode 334 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds, and today we have on the show legendary producer, engineer, musician, witness to music history, storyteller, and historian, Jack Endino. Now, Jack was present and behind the board for many bands you know and albums you love. He's worked with Nirvana, Soundgarden, Tad, Screaming Trees, Mudhoney, just to name a few, and he's played on many records himself as well. Today, Jack is going to share all about his time and perspective and experiences recording these bands and producing vinyl records. He's going to talk about the remixes and remasters for the likes of Nirvana and Soundgarden. We'll cover some rare records he's got, some rare records he's recorded, and his new LP, Set Myself on Fire. You can stream the album right now. I suggest you do. Load it up. Jack Endino, Set Myself on Fire. Check it out, and there is vinyl available, red copies, black copies, autograph copies, and more at CapacitorRecords.com. And as usual, I've made available an extended and ad-free version of this interview available only to show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. Now, if you've thought about helping out this show in the past, well, now is the time. Get episodes early, enjoy extended versions and all the extras at patreon.com/vinylguide. Plus, with your support, you get the warm fuzzies of knowing that you're helping out this show, buying me a beer or a burrito, and contributing to me pumping out these episodes. That's patreon.com/vinylguide, and thanks in advance, you handsome beast, you. If you like this interview with Jack Endino, make sure to check out some of our other 300-plus episodes of The Vinyl Guide, including episode 219 with Matt Cameron of Soundgarden and Pearl Jam, episode 331 with John Dwyer of The OCs, episode 327 with Eric Kretz of Stone Temple Pilots, episode 293 with Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, episodes 281 and 282 with Ian MacKay of Minor Threat, Fugazi, and Discord Records, episode 266 with Rick Nielsen of Cheap Trick, and hundreds of others. Just subscribe to The Vinyl Guide in your podcast app. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. And that's it for the upfronts. Let's get straight into our conversation with Mr. Jack Endino. Let's just cut right into it, you know? I don't know if you're too familiar with our show, but we talk a lot about records. We collect records. And I would imagine, just from your history and your lineage and the generation you came from, you probably have a pretty good stash of records in the house. Would that be fair?
Well, if you look behind my... That there is just the CDs behind me. And... out of camera range is the half of the wall, floor to ceiling, that is the vinyl part. So there's probably 2,000 records there. And because of what I do for a living, even though I don't buy a lot of vinyl anymore, you know, as of about 10 years ago, the records I produce started showing up on vinyl again. So, you know, I still get boxes of records coming in all the time now, you know, courtesy copies of the stuff that I'm working on. And I do a lot of mastering now as well. So, in fact, that's probably half my work is mastering. So a lot of what I'm doing is coming back to me as vinyl, which is interesting to compare, you know, the sound of the CD versus the sound of the vinyl. But that could be a deep story, a deep subject there.
Do you have a preference? Like if you're going to listen to an album and you've got a CD, you've got a copy on vinyl, is there a way you lean?
I will absolutely listen to the CD before I will pull out the vinyl. You know, it's more convenient. I can just put it in and forget about it. I don't have to stop and flip it over. Mm-hmm. I know that the actual recording that I made was done digitally, and that the CD is an absolute reflection of what I was hearing in the studio or what I was hearing when I mastered it. Mm-hmm. The vinyl always changes. The ways in which it changes are not entirely consistent from the disc cutting engineer to disc cutting engineer. They're not consistent from pressing to pressing. Vinyl has a lot of slop in it. There's a lot of factors involved that are out of my control once the digital master leaves my hands. Mm-hmm. So it's always a little of a crapshoot. What am I going to get back? You know, is it going to sound like I thought it would sound? Usually it does. I've gotten pretty good at sort of, you know, thinking ahead of the game and you know, listening to what I do and so forth. But yeah, vinyl is a little, you know, there's a lot of variables that are introduced into the process after the master leaves my studio.
Are you finding a difference between the vinyl experience of, say, 30 years ago and the vinyl experience of things that are pressed now?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure about all the vinyl pressing plants that exist now. I don't have as much confidence as I did in the 80s when people had been doing it sometimes for decades. And I think possibly during the almost 20 years when there wasn't a lot of vinyl coming out, we may have lost some talent and some knowledge, as it were. You know, on the other hand, maybe there's some newer technology coming online. I suspect that's true. I do know that toward the end of the original vinyl era, I started noticing, and this was when people were mixing to digital and making digital masters, but when we didn't have high-res digital yet, it was all people mixing to DAT machines. Mm-hmm. 16-bit audio was being used to cut vinyl. And I remember noticing back in the late 80s and early 90s that, well, the CD is sounding better to me than the vinyl. And I realized that, you know, if the vinyl is made from a 16-bit master and the CD is made from a 16-bit master, one of those is closer to the source than the other. Mm-hmm. And it ain't the vinyl. And I was very happy when pressing plants and people cutting acetates finally, you know, sometime in the 2000s, it started to become more of a standard procedure to cut the acetate from a higher resolution digital master, 24-bit. Now it's no problem if I send a 24-bit 96K digital master to have an acetate cut. Nobody blinks an eye. But that was not universal. And the high-res digital audio didn't really become more commonplace until around the turn of the century here. So I'm pretty happy that the vinyl now is being cut from a much higher definition, higher resolution audio than the CDs are. So that's a good thing. But the whole vinyl process is still, there's a lot of variables and a lot that can change.
I could tell you're being very polite in your opinion of vinyl, I guess. Does it surprise you about this vinyl revival of the last 10 years?
It's kind of delightful in a way because, you know, album graphics are back, which I think is wonderful. And, you know, for a long time, I was kind of cynical about it when this sort of vinyl resurgence came about because the vinyl always had a download card in it. And I was fairly convinced that a lot of people were buying them as collector's items, but, you know, would just download the files and listen to them on their iPod or whatever the heck they had. You know, I wasn't sure how many people were actually even listening to the vinyl or how many people still had turntables for that matter. You got to think about that.
Yeah. When,
you know, I mean, I've got an old Classic Techniques turntable that's probably 30 years old. You know, probably a lot of people still have those. New turntables with built-in USB connections on them. You know, I'm not fully on board with this. I mean, my stereo equipment is from the 70s. I've had it all recapped. I take care of it. I've got a big old Sansui G8000 receiver behind me in the living room that's it probably weighs 50 pounds. Sounds amazing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I've got old-fashioned stereo. But, you know, and again, look at what people are listening to these days. They're listening on these little tiny speakers that people use. I mean, I had giant speakers in the corners of my living room you know, you'd sit between those in the 70s and turn up Dark Side of the Moon and have your mind blown. And people are listening on these little mini speakers now. So, or with little earbuds or whatever. Anyway, don't get me started. I'm sounding very curmudgeonly here, which is probably what I look like right
back
now.
Back in my day.
Well, you kids get off my lawn. But no, I'm kind of delighted that, you know, I mean, all these records, you know, I mean, I have like multiple records that have come out that, you know, this is kind of nuts. All this stuff has come out on, you know, oh, look, here's my Australian copy of Bleach.
Ooh, on Waterfront?
It's on Waterfront. I found it in Chile at a street market.
Oh my goodness.
I was like, yeah.
All right. Well,
so I thought, oh, that's cool. I don't have one of those. So you know, I'm kind of delighted to see the vinyl thing happening. But it's a continual battle to get, you know, to make sure that that the pressings actually sound good. I have another story I can tell you about this, but why don't you go on?
Please. If you've got a vinyl story, we're all ears.
I do. There's a record that I made a few years ago. It was an archival record for a band called The Tiny Holes. And this came out on K Records. And Bruce Pavitt was actually the lead singer of this band. It was from 1980 or 1981. Mm-hmm. And it was a live recording. It was multi-track. And it was the only recorded evidence of this band. And it was actually pretty good. It's a kind of a geeky new wave record. It sounds kind of Talking Heads, but it's very typical of a Seattle band of 1980, 81. Yeah. And they were playing a live show. It was in Olympia. And K Records, Calvin at K, hired me to mix this down and master it and get it ready for a vinyl reissue that was due to come out on Record Store Day a few years ago. So I mixed it. Everybody was happy, mastered it. I know the mastering engineer, or excuse me, the disc acetate cutting engineer, the guy with the lathe. I know him pretty well. He's done a lot of cuts for me. So I got the test pressing and I played it and immediately was like, you know, ready to kill myself. So what have I done wrong? I've done something terribly wrong here because this sounds awful. What's happened? And I put it on my spectrum analyzer and I saw that there was nothing above 5K. And I thought, this is strange. And I went and I got the files that I had mastered that had been sent to the guy who cut the acetate. And I played it and I thought, well, that's what it should sound like. And it doesn't. And, you know, I thought, well, you know, do I rock the boat here? It's not going to make the deadline, but this can't be right. So I called up the guy who cut the acetate. And I said, did you save your settings exactly? He says, of course I did. I document everything meticulously. And I said, can you cut me another acetate exactly with the same settings that you used when you cut the acetate for this record before it went to the plant to make the test pressing? And he said, sure. So I talked to Calvin and he was willing to, because he didn't like the sound either. He had heard my original master. And so he agreed to pay for an extra acetate. And I got the acetate sent to me, a one-off. I said, don't even bother. Just do one side. It's fine. Mm-hmm. And it sounded exactly like my digital master. Like, in other words, like it sounded like it was supposed to sound.
Right.
Now, the whole point of it is the test pressing is supposed to sound like the acetate. That's the point of the entire process. Mm-hmm. And so it turned out there had been a problem in the plating part. Something had happened. Something of the solution was at the wrong temperature. I don't know. I'm just speculating. But basically, the company who made the stampers had to eat it and make another run at it.
Right.
And the whole thing got delayed by another 6 months. But it's a band from 1980, so nobody really heard that much. And the record finally came out, and it sounded fine, and it was good. But that was kind of a warning to me to always get a test pressing. And if I could afford it, I would always get an acetate too. But now acetates are extremely expensive.
Right.
So, you know, it's kind of, you're kind of crossing your fingers and hoping that the test pressing will come back sounding like it should. And if it doesn't, whose fault is it? Do you know? You don't.
There's so many steps in the process that it could, there's multiple points of failure.
Yeah. By having an acetate and comparing it with my master, I was able to verify that it wasn't my problem. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the acetate's problem. It was downstream. But You know, I was lucky to have control of those variables. So, you know, vinyl, I cross my fingers now.
It's in God's hands. In the past, have you been very much around like the cutting of the lacquers? Did you participate in that process at all? Or was it always to a cutting engineer to do that?
I've never seen it in person because there hasn't, historically, there has never been a pressing plant in Seattle. There are some people, there's a guy with a lathe that I've heard of here in Seattle somewhere. But I haven't been to his facility actually. So there's at least one guy cutting vinyl or cutting acetates here in Seattle that I know of. He's out in a suburb. Years ago, there was a vinyl pressing plant in Vancouver, British Columbia, which, you know, is just over the border from Seattle. It's about roughly a 2-hour drive, assuming you don't get hung up at the border, to get to Vancouver, BC. And there was a company there called Imperial Records, which in the early 80s and in the 70s, all of the Seattle indie bands would have their records cut and pressed at Imperial Records in Canada because of the difference between the US and Canadian dollar. It was a great deal. And they had some kind of agreement with the customs in order to get the records back and forth over the border without some big tax happening. It was all above board. And the very first Skinyard 7-inch, I think, my band Skinyard back in the 80s, was pressed at Imperial Records. And I specifically remember I had one chance. I went up to visit the factory and got a tour of the factory, and it was pretty impressive. It's the only time I've seen an actual vinyl pressing plant, and they showed me where they were cutting the acetates, and then they showed me the electroplating tanks where they were making the stampers and the big machines and the giant bins of vinyl pellets and the massive it needs a tremendous ventilation system, and I think it probably must have been maybe steam heat that was something that was melting the vinyl and running it through these pipes. And it was an incredible just massive industrial setup with toxic waste and crazy ventilation and steam pipes. And I mean, it was impressive. And ever since then, when people have asked me, hey, what do you think, I had someone ask me about, investing in starting a vinyl pressing plant from scratch. And I sort of said, well, there's this and that and the permits and the toxic waste and you'll need like massive electrical power and, toxic chemicals because there's like cyanide, plating tanks. It's like toxic waste. It's heavy duty, and it would be really hard to get the permitting to do that these days anywhere within a major city.
Civilization.
Yeah, in civilization, So I said, well, good luck, there's people who've done it, but not in Seattle. So anyway, since then, incidentally, that record pressing plant, Imperial Records, got busted for pressing bootlegs and went out of business in 1987.
Okay. All right.
There's a famous bootleg of Bob Dylan called Great White Wonder that apparently came from that factory.
So I'll send you a link to one of the episodes we had with the Trademark Equality guys.
TMQ.
Yeah.
I love those records.
Yeah. And they went through the whole kind of history of things in it. So if you're a bit of a bootleg nerd, that'll be a good one for you.
I was once at a time. I probably have a few of those TMQ records, and they may have been made at Imperial Records in Vancouver.
Wherever they were made, it was for cash.
Yeah, cash probably under the table.
I went when I was years and years ago. This is the mid 80s. I went to Rainbow Records in Los Angeles, and I had these thoughts when I was going up there. I was in a band. We were picking up our first 7-inch or whatever. We were all excited to see the record pressing plants. And in our minds, it was like Willy Wonka. Like, oh, can you imagine? There's just going to be all these really cool titles there we can see and everything. It looked like a place where you'd get your brakes done. It's a workshop.
It's pretty industrial.
Yeah. There's nothing exciting about it. The walls were dirty. There was like these notes stapled to the walls, and it was like things that had been there for a decade or whatever. It was they were not spending extra money on cleaning services. It was not a pretty sight.
No, it's like visiting the Lockheed Skunk Works or something, you know. Here's where they put the jet engines together.
Yeah.
You know.
Nothing romantic about it at all.
No.
So when you're mixing current day, do you do a special version for vinyl and a special version for digital?
No, that's for mastering.
Okay.
For mastering, I'll make a slightly different EQ for vinyl than I do for digital. And, you know, when I'm mixing, I'm very conscientious about sibilance and certain things that I know give trouble for vinyl, like making sure things are not 180 degree out of phase between left and right. You know, that's something that I've had the people who cut the acetates tell me, don't ever do that, you know, because otherwise you know, the needle will jump out of the groove. And, you know, making sure that the bass elements are centered again, mm-hmm. to make sure that you don't kick the needle out of the groove. It's certain things that I would probably be doing anyway, but you have to be very conscientious about it when you're mixing and you know that it's going to go to vinyl. You know, certain things that you might pan drastically left and right, you just don't do that.
Have you had incidents where you've mixed something and it's been pressed up and it's had those adverse effects?
Personally, no. A cutting engineer once complained to me that my toms were panned too far apart, and that he had to reduce the volume of the cut a little bit because of that.
Okay.
And it was because the record I had been given to me with the drums as a single stereo mix. It was a live recording, and I said, "Oh, oops, sorry." You know, that's kind of how it came to me. But I took that to heart, you know. You know, again, the percussive elements that are panned too far apart, left and right, that might kick the needle out of the groove. So you got to be careful.
These days, you're doing a lot of remasters. Are you doing many remixes?
Well, as a matter of fact, yes. You may know about Soundgarden's debut album. Well, their debut EP was called Screaming Life, and they did it with me in an 8-track studio in 1987. But then their debut record is called Ultra Mega Okay, and I didn't record that. It came out on SST Records in, I think, 1989, 1990, something like that. It's hard for me to remember the exact date. But long story short, I ended up remixing the entire record, and Sub Pop reissued it on vinyl and CD and cassette a couple of years ago. And that was pretty satisfying because I was able to get the original 16-track, 1-inch analog tapes and worked with the band members on that. It was one of the last major projects that Soundgarden did as a band. Mm-hmm. That was pretty satisfying. The vinyl pressing came out sounding very good. Everything came out the way I wanted it to. I had a chance to supervise the remastering of Bleach for the second or third time a few years back. And I got George Marino to do the cut. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, this is the guy who supervised the remastering of a bunch of the Zeppelin catalog and some Hendrix and so forth. And I knew that he was good. And, I told him, look, this record is millions of copies have been sold. Everybody's used to the way it sounds. So if you're going to remaster it, it's first do no harm. You don't squash it. You don't blow it up. You know, keep it accurate, keep it faithful to the original feel. You know, no, your mission here is not to make it louder than any record ever. And he was old fashioned and he was happy to accommodate. And so the last most recent edition of the Bleach record, I think is pretty good, pretty accurate. Yeah. And I'm happy with that. There was the Green River catalog got reissued by Sub Pop a couple years ago, and I was able to remaster all of it and remix the final Green River LP, which was called Rehab Doll, which again was a mix that I had nothing to do with the recording, but the band had never been that happy with how the record sounded because they broke up while the record was being mixed and kind of took their eye off the ball. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to engage everybody and everybody said, okay, Jack, do it, make it sound like it was supposed to sound if we had been there. And so that was pretty satisfying. So there's a certain amount of this archival stuff that has been coming to me over the last decade where people dig up the records that they did for like $200 in 19, you know, 87, and they think, well, wait a minute, let's let's spend a couple days mixing it this time, you know,
right?
And instead of a couple hours or whatever it is, you know. Anyway, I'm happy to accommodate. And there's a lot of remastering I've done too for things that maybe came out in the early CD era and now just don't sound that good. Among others, some of the things I did for my own band that I've had a chance to revisit. So that's been satisfying as well.
Mm. How do you ride that balance of preserving the sound that, you know, we all fell in love with back in the day, but also introducing updates with the modern remix? I mean, that must be a precarious balance you need to ride there.
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, let me tell you about AudiophileUSA.com. AudiophileUSA.com is a fantastic place to buy used records online. AudiophileUSA.com has a heap of inventory, like tens of thousands of records you could search through online, and they are all excellent and near mint quality. These are your final upgrades, beautiful records that you can enjoy for years to come. AudiophileUSA.com is a family-owned and operated business, and they work hard to find the absolute cleanest records in the world and make them available to you. Head up there now, AudiophileUSA.com, search and dig through their selection and find the deals. Get a box of love on its way to you now from AudiophileUSA.com. Now, I know that you know that the Groove Washer is the best record cleaner in the world, but did you know that Groove Washer now makes archival quality record sleeves too? Yep. The world's best record cleaner is now making some fantastic sleeves and record accessories for a limited time introductory offer. The Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves are absolutely fantastic, so head up there now and try them for yourself. Go to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10. That's the Groove Washer record cleaners, record sleeves, and other protection for your record collection. That's groovewasher.com.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
How do you ride that balance of preserving the sound that, you know, we all fell in love with back in the day, but also introducing updates with the modern remix? I mean, that must be a precarious balance you need to ride there.
It's not hard for me because I still have the same aesthetic that I had back then. I just have way more technical skills than I had in, you know, in the early days. Mm-hmm. A lot of those records I did in the late 80s, the old Seattle grunge records that people talk about and the early stuff on Sub Pop, the stuff that I kind of made my reputation on, I'd only been engineering for a few years at that point. And I mean, mm-hmm. we had an 8-track studio. I barely knew what I was doing. Maybe I got lucky. I just had good instincts. I mean, I guess I was good at what I was doing, but I was a little, you know, working from the seat of my pants.
Yeah.
And, you know, after doing this for 35 years, I feel like I'm just starting to get a handle on it. You know, if I keep doing this, I might get good at it, you know? That's kind of what I tell people now. So, you know, I still have the same aesthetic. I know enough not to fall down the volume war rabbit hole that everybody went down around the year 2000. And you know exactly what I'm talking about, where, you know, digital mastering allowed people to just get things louder and louder and louder to where the average signal level and the maximum peak signal level started to converge more and more and more to where you had less and less and less dynamics and records became fatiguing to listen to. Now you have a volume knob on your stereo for a reason, or assuming you have a stereo. Don't get me started into the automatic volume adjustments of all the streaming services and so forth now. But
as I understand, the volume wars started largely because bands wanted to sound similar on the radio in comparison to the song that came before them.
Well, forgetting that the radio has a built-in compressor in it. The radio transmitting situation has a massive compressor that makes sure that everything that comes out sounds the same volume because you want to maximize the modulation of the radio signal. The other thing, it's this, you couldn't have a volume war scenario in the vinyl era because the way vinyl is what it is, the level at which the grooves are cut into the acetate is based on the audio frequency spectrum of the audio and how long the side is. The more music you cram onto the side, once you go over about 18 minutes, you have to start dropping the volume level at which the acetate is cut in order to physically fit the grooves onto the record. So you get a record that's 22, 23 minutes a side. It's going to be 3, 4, 5 dB quieter than a record that was, you know, 16 or 17 minutes on a side. Mm-hmm. Sure, we have, there's good technology for cutting acetates now that maybe didn't exist 30 or 40 years ago, but still the physical limitations of the medium remain. You can't get, you know, you can only get so much volume onto a piece of vinyl. The actual volume level of vinyl is not standardized. It's based on those factors I told you. They make it as loud as they can for a given piece of audio and a given program length and given frequency response, but you know, it is what it is. Vinyl records are all over the place. Long records are quieter than shorter records. CDs sort of took that out of the equation so that the only limitation was absolute digital zero, the very loudest of the loud, mm-hmm. where the math runs out. So it became a game of getting everything as close to digital zero as you could. So it became a compression and limiting game of how much can you put up with before you start hating how it sounds? Because to a certain extent, it becomes more and more exciting. It's kind of distorted. It's urgent. It's strident. It's in your face. But then after a while, song after song is like that, and you start to get a little fatigued listening to it because there's no relief. So people finally started to pull back from that. It was a regrettable era. But vinyl had nothing to do with it except that people would make a digital master for CD that was massively compressed and tremendously loud. Yeah. And then you press the vinyl, and unfortunately the vinyl, it's the average volume level that affects how the record is cut. And the vinyl would come back at the same volume level that it would have anyway, except now there's no dynamics in it. You know, nothing sticks out. So when I master for vinyl, I usually specifically pull the limiting back a little bit pull the levels down a little bit, because I know that whoever's cutting it is going to cut it at whatever volume they want to. I have no control over that. So I might as well give them something with some dynamics in it. And I think subjectively, it seems to me that the things that come back from vinyl, there's probably some limiting that goes that's in the signal chain before the acetate is cut. It may be subtle, but I have no control over it, whatever it is. Dang. So I always assume that they're going to add a little bit more compression to whatever I give them. So I back it off on my end before I send it off.
So you put notes in the file. Do you have a relationship with these people who are cutting your materials? Other than
a
just
couple of
to-
them, yes. A couple of them I do know. I can email them directly and just say, look, here's this thing I got. Here's what I'm dealing with. Yeah, I can actually call them and say, look, you know, if you have any questions, let me know. If you need me to, you know, if the kick drum's bothering you, or you need me to make one with less low end, or if there's too much sibilance going on, just, you know, give me a call. But they usually know what to do. I've gotten pretty good at sort of predictive, you know, knowing in advance what I need to do. Because these records come back and I listen to them and I go, oh, okay, I see. This is good, but I could have done this or I could have done that.
So even though you don't prefer the vinyl format, you still go through all the test pressings of the projects you're involved in. They come
Absolutely.
Back to you. You give them some time and occasionally
if I get
catch
the courtesy
issue.
Of getting a test pressing, I don't always. You know, sometimes people just go ahead and just they say, it's great. And I go, okay, I hope so. You know, and then I never hear any more about it. So it must have been good. You don't always get a test pressing. I mean, it's nice if I can get one, but it's kind of a luxury. I mean, I have a pretty big pile of test pressings here from records. And, you know, in some cases, there's, you know, you discover that, you know, all the copies of a test pressing have got a big tick at exactly the 16 minutes and 47 seconds mark on side two or something like that. And, you know, unless you have more than one test pressing, you're not going to know if it's just on your one copy or if it's in the pressing. Mm-hmm. And I've had people catch that stuff. That's what the test pressing is for. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the test pressing is important, but it does like delay your product. Now, here's the thing. Right now, records are tremendously delayed. All the pressing plants are way behind. So I've had a recent record that I did. They opted not to do a test pressing just because otherwise it was going to be another 3 months. luckily, the record came out fine. But I was sort of, you know, kind of biting my nails, you know, sort of crossing my fingers, hoping that this was going to be not one of the problem pressings.
For your latest solo album, Set Myself on Fire, did you do test pressings? And did
yes,
you?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, I imagine you did, and I imagine the person mastering was like, "Oh fuck, it's Jack." Okay,
maybe I don't know. You know, they don't. I can't assume that everybody knows who the hell I am. You know, there are many generations of people involved in this business, and I am admittedly somewhat of a one man niche, I guess.
Well, look, I know some artists that are also very deep listeners as well. You know, their names aren't on the back of as many records as yours, but they're performers. They are audiophiles, and
they pay very much attention,
especially when it's like, yeah, they're releasing an album every 5 years or something. They're focused in on it, and yeah, they're not shy about turning them back and having them redo something.
Now we did good on my solo record. The guys who pressed my record, they went through a factory. It's called the GZ plant. It's in the Czech Republic, I think. In the US, we have a broker called Pirates Press that deals with them. But the interesting thing about them is they don't do acetates. They do some kind of direct to metal thing. So you don't get an acetate, you get a test pressing. And the test pressing sounded exceptional. It sounded great. You know, I got it back and it was exactly what I wanted it to sound like. And I know there's a metal label here in the US called Relapse that I've done quite a few records for, actually. And many of them have been on vinyl and I've mastered a few of them. And they also deal with the GZ plant. And sometimes, you know, metal is tricky because there'll be a lot of low end and they tend to make records that are long. You know, you'll have a 22-minute, 23-minute side. You know, it's hard to tell a metal band, look, you've got to drop a song here. You know, there's 52 minutes on your record. This is going to be kind of a problem for the vinyl. And, you know, it's like, which baby do I execute? You know, they don't want to do that, but you know, it is what it is. The label's not willing to press, you know, a double LP with two 30-minute albums. You know what I mean? But yeah, the GZ plant seems to be, you know, whatever their process of cutting direct to metal, it works pretty well because I've had really good results coming back from records that have come from there, my own solo record among them. So I'm pretty happy with how it sounds on vinyl. It's about as good as it could sound.
Now you've got on your solo album, you've got a red version and a black version.
True.
Do you have a preference of either, or can you even sonically tell the difference between the two?
You know what? I haven't actually compared them. You know, in fact, I don't think I've played the pressed copy. I played the test pressing and I okayed it. And I don't think I've ever listened to the rest of them. You know, people tell me it sounds good and I'm willing to take their word for it. But,
right. You
know, it's not high on my list to listen to my own solo record these days. I've got enough other people's records that I need to be paying attention to. You know, and since the test pressing was good and, you know, I hear everybody likes it, I'm like, okay, great. I don't have to listen to it now. You know, and I did, I think, yeah, no, it's, I haven't compared. I mean, I am told anecdotally that the black vinyl probably could be expected to sound better than the red vinyl. And I know from past experience with colored vinyl that after you store them for years and years, the colored vinyl is more likely to be slightly warped. That has been my experience with other records I've done. Depending on where they came from. I mean, my fingers are crossed on that. It's not universal, but it did happen with the first Skin Yard record 30 years ago that all of the colored vinyl copies a decade later were slightly dished. Most of them were still playable, but they weren't perfectly flat anymore. Another record that I did about 10 years ago where the clear vinyl copies, again, several years later, were no longer perfectly flat. But again, not universal. It's just a risk.
I've heard the discoloration. I've heard of, you know, you get a bright yellow or a clear vinyl, and then a decade or more later, it can kind of get cloudy. I've heard that.
The sound?
No. The appearance. The appearance.
Oh, the physical appearance.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
It's remote cases. I'm not entirely sure. I've got all the right information, but I've heard that.
I couldn't even speculate on that.
But what I've actually heard is that the colored vinyl, things like a red, like your solo album, that vinyl is actually likely to be more pure because the black vinyl in the hoppers in the pressing plants, that's where they put the offcuts, the regrind, some stuff like that could end up in black because it all gets kind of hidden. At the end of the day or at the end of the week, they've done blue vinyl, red vinyl, gray vinyl, and then they have all these bits of pellets left over from different colors. They throw those in the black because it'll get all mixed in.
That may be true in some plants. I mean, and that's probably the difference between so-called virgin vinyl and other kinds of vinyl. Mm. And you may be right about that, because I remember hearing that there's a certain degree of, I mean, they have to take the trim and recycle it because it's just this, it's the same vinyl. It just happened to squirt out of the press and they throw it back in. I don't know. You'd have to ask someone at a pressing plant about this. You might know more than I do about this, actually.
Yeah, I know I have, and they're not always entirely forthcoming.
Yes, I would expect so.
So speaking of sound, the recent remasters of these records you've been working on, let's take Bleach, for example. What's changed in the more modern remaster than there was back in 89?
To be honest, I don't think much. Mm-hmm. You know, the remastering probably is more obvious on the CD versions of the record than it is on the vinyl versions of the record. Because again, you know, the vinyl is going to be cut at the volume that it's cut mm-hmm. based on how long the record is. That may not change much. I haven't had a chance to literally A/B the vinyl pressings. Right. It's been about a decade since the last one. There may be a little more consistency from song to song because I wasn't, you know, involved when the record was originally mastered in 1989. Okay. John Golden did that. He was a wonderful mastering engineer who did a lot of the early Sub Pop stuff, a lot of indie stuff, actually. John Golden, he's a great guy. I think he's kind of semi-retired now. His son, JJ Golden, is the one who does most of the work at Golden Mastering. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure what I can add to that, really. I haven't had a chance to compare meaningfully. And, you know, the references that I was given were digital until I got a physical test pressing. So I had to sort of trust that the record would be pressed correctly based on the remastered digital files. Now, it's rare for people to cut vinyl directly. I think you could ask Steve Albini about this because he's been very meticulous about it a few times, of mixing a record directly to analog tape. Mm-hmm. Having it mastered to another piece of analog tape, when, you know, you end up getting hiss on top of hiss if you do that. But and then cutting the acetate directly from the analog master. I think that's how it was done in the 70s. You would have the mixed version and then you would have a mastered. You'd have either the master would happen live coming off the spliced sequenced tape of mixes. You would be mastering it live directly to the acetate in real time as it was going by. You had to change your settings. I'm kind of glad we're not doing that anymore.
It's a white knuckle ride.
I'm just so happy that we can, that people can cut from 24-bit 96K now. It's just, you have a chance to, like, you know, get it right without having to, you know, you get one chance and then you've burned through your acetate and have to grab another one and do it again.
All the tapes you're working with these bands from 30 years back, are those tapes decaying?
Yes.
Okay.
Everything prior to about the year 2005 that I've been handed has had to be, now we call it baked. I'll show you something here. Let me step out of the camera for a minute. So this thing, here's my handy Snackmaster food dehydrator. Yeah. This contains trays in it that look like this. You can't quite see them. I'll pull it back. Mm-hmm. It's got a tray inside it. It looks like this. Yep. And it's exactly the right size to put a reel of tape on it. A 10-inch reel fits exactly in this machine. And it's got several levels of these. So you put your tapes in the food dehydrator and you set it for 115 or 120 degrees and you let it run overnight and you take the tapes out and they play without shedding, without any oxide coming off. Doesn't affect the audio at all. So I've had to bake literally hundreds of tapes because like I said, anything older than about 15 years ago, if I put it on my tape machine, it will play for about a minute and then it will start squeaking and then it will stop because it will have literally glued itself to the heads because of the brown, the brown oxide, the goop just starts coming off. And the oxide on the tape has a binder that slowly absorbs moisture over the decades and becomes gummy. And if you put it in the food dehydrator and dry it out under, you know, it's warm heat. It's not even hot. It's no hotter than a hair dryer. In fact, it's probably less than that. It reactivates the binder, basically dries the glue up again, and you can play the tape from beginning to end without a single speck appearing on the heads. So it's kind of miraculous, you know, and I've had to, you can resuscitate these tapes to where they play perfectly. Now, anything prior to 1970, I'm not so sure about because A, I don't get those very much. And B, I think the tape formulations were different. The old acetate tapes, you might damage them if you try baking them. And I think there was a different formulation. Some of the old tapes still play perfectly. But there was a whole period in which Ampex, you know, and Scotch and, whoever was BASF, those were the three biggies, and Agfa was the other one that I've had terrible problems with. Those were the four big tape manufacturers in the 70s and 80s. And all of those tapes from that era have not stood the test of time very well. So, if you get one, you got to bake it.
So let me get this straight. You take these recordings from bands that, you know, we all have heard, loved, and have in our collection, and you put them in that that food dehydrator, and no offense to your home appliances, but I always thought that there was this kind of oven, this particular formula, this, you know, a couple guys in lab coats that had to bake these tapes in order for them to get played. You're saying a common food dehydrator will do the same thing and you're comfortable?
It's nonsense. I mean, it's 120, it's literally warm air. It's not even gonna hurt you. It's just warm air. All you're doing is driving the moisture out. Now, if you crank it up to 140 degrees and leave it, you might start affecting the audio a little bit. But tape is pretty robust, and those magnetic domains are pretty robust. Now, if I put it in that dehydrator and walked away for a week, I might come back and find that the high frequency content of the tape may have changed a little bit. That hasn't happened so far, and I've been pretty meticulous about this. I mean, I've heard of people baking tapes at 125, 135 degrees, but I always set it at a lower temperature. And, you know, I'll pull it out and I'll check it and I'll play it. And if it's still shedding a little bit, it goes back in for another 5 or 6 hours. So, you know, you do have to be careful, but I've learned from experience that these tapes are pretty robust and the sound doesn't change. What's more, there's tapes that I've had to bake, and then 10 years later, I get presented with the tape again for another reissue. And well, looky here, it's shedding again. I've got to bake it a second time. And the audio's fine. So tape is pretty robust, but you don't hit it very hard. You just want to just warm it enough to dry the moisture out of it. There's one limitation here, and I'll tell you what it is. If there's tape splices, they dry out. And then the tape falls apart when you play it. Because the splices between the songs, the tape splice, the actual splicing tape, the glue has dried up. So I frequently have to like re-splice the songs together after I do the baking because of that. Not always, but if they use the cheap white kind of splicing tape, that happens. If they use the blue stuff, which nobody makes this anymore, but the blue splicing tape seems to have held up better with time. The old white splicing tape with the paper leader that would be between the songs, completely dries up and falls apart. You play the tape and it's playing fine, and then droop, comes to the end of the song and you're looking at two reels that are, you know, anyway, never mind. Go ahead. It's just one of those, you know, unwanted side effects that you have to be ready for.
Are any of the artists or projects you worked on originally, did they have their master tapes or the multi-track tapes that were destroyed in that Universal Music fire?
Nobody's talking. So I would expect that some people that I know and that you know may have lost their master tapes in that whole thing, but nobody will say. I do know that when that happened, I was able to call up one of my friends at Universal and remind him that the In Utero tapes had recently been used for some remixing, and that I knew where they were. You know, because a lot of these tapes are not in the vault. They get pulled out for video games and people making stems and people doing remixes and people doing this or the other, you know, or remasters or reissues or whatever. So I suspect that a lot of the stuff that got lost in that Universal fire was probably the deep archive stuff that nobody had looked at in a while, because the stuff that it's, you know, that's getting, you know, that's in play currently tends to be out of the vault and at this or that studio or mastering house or whatever. So I suspect the stuff that got lost was probably the really valuable historical stuff, but I don't know. Nobody will talk about that. There may have been lawsuits. I don't know. You know, you and I are never going to find out the truth of that exactly.
All right. Okay. But it does sound like In Utero escaped that.
I know that it did, because I knew where the tapes were at the time. I remember thinking, I talked to their manager and I said, "Hey, I know where the In Utero tapes are right now." And he went, "Oh, right." You know, that was just one example, actually. And I know that none of the Sub Pop tapes were there, because Sub Pop has their own situation. This was when we were working on the In Utero reissue a few years ago, the big massive reissue. I got to do some mixing of some unreleased stuff that got used on the deluxe version. You know, tapes that had been pulled out and recently messed with, you know, that those weren't the ones that got burned. It was probably the, you know, the Miles Davis record from 1962.
Otis Redding's and stuff.
Yeah. You know, like the historical stuff that nobody had messed with in a while. I don't know. We may never know.
Yeah. It sounds like you are still very much in that Nirvana universe in terms of being involved in all the different projects, even knowing what projects are happening. You were a consultant for the Lights Out box set. Like, what role do you currently play kind of in that Nirvana universe?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I recorded the band with like five different drummers. If you consider the Jury project with Mark Pickrell drumming, Dale Crover was recording on some songs that I was playing on some songs I did. I did the recordings with Chad. I did the song with Dan Peters, and I did some demos with Dave Grohl in the band. So, you know, I've been present for quite a few versions of the band, and I continue to work with Chris Novoselic on his solo projects. And I just sort of know where the bodies are buried, as it were. You know, I did a lot of research. I had assistance from my friend Jillian Garr, who's a fairly meticulous documenter of these things. And, I know, like, when they can call me and say, "Hey, you know, who's got this or that tape?" And I can go, "Oh, that's so-and-so. Here, you know, here's his number, you know, ask him, you know, oh yeah, Barrett Jones, he's got that," or, you know, whatever. John Goodmanson, he did that one in 1987. So, you know, I'm kind of a one-stop shop of technical trivia for that, for the Nirvana vault, if you will. But I mean, and, you know, I ended up doing some stuff on the Nevermind reissue that recently came out.
The 30-year one? Yeah.
Yeah, there's a bunch of live stuff that they had me work on that needed to be massaged somewhat. So they handed the live portion of it off to me to do some mixing. And that was kind of satisfying, actually, hearing these, like, recordings from, you know, 1992, 93. So you know, they throw me the odd archival job from time to time when something comes up.
Is there anything still out in the wild, or is it pretty much all been gathered? What's releasable is released, and there's not much meat left on the bone.
Yeah, I think what's left is a lot of live stuff. There's a lot of live recordings that have been, you know, that are in a vault somewhere. I think, you know, by and large, a lot of the great stuff has come out. I don't think there's a lot of studio stuff of any kind. There may be a couple alternate versions of a song here and there. I think what's left is a lot. There's a lot of live recordings that were done, especially during the In Utero era of the band, when they had Pat Smear playing with them. You know, so there's probably some live stuff that will still be that will still be trickled out, I'm guessing. Like as it is with this Nevermind reissue, there's like four complete live shows that they were able to pick from for bonus material, which was kind of nice. And most of it had been out on the bootleg market. This is the other thing. Most of the live stuff has been bootlegged. So, you know, there's not going to be any big revelations as far as that goes. The fans have been meticulous about gathering this stuff. I mean, I had access to some original tapes, which was nice. But in some cases, I called up some people I knew and I said, look, you know, can you give me some copies of what's out there on the bootleg market? I want to make sure that what I have is actually the right source and that, you know, the quality is good. I mean, what's the best? I actually called up some people I know who are tied in with this. And I said, send me some files of your best audio of this or that show. And let me compare with what I'm working with. And that was useful because, you know, if I'm going to improve it, I better improve it. You know, because they're going to know. Those people pay attention.
Hey, you're competing with free.
Yeah, exactly. Free, but of unknown, you know, how many generations of audio have these bootlegs gone through, you know?
I do want to talk about your solo album. Before we get too much further, though, can you pull out that Chilean bleach, that waterfront that you had?
Yeah, let me show you this.
Yeah, show me that.
So this is from... It's a blue, it's got the blue thing on it. And let's pull out the vinyl and look at it. Now, again, I found this in Chile. It cost me $20. I was kind of shocked and thought, you know, this was only a few years ago. I thought, what the hell? Have I seen this before?
Okay, show me the label. Pull the label really close to the camera here.
Yeah, and we have to hope this is not in itself a pirate.
It is.
Is it a pirate?
It is a pirate. And I'll tell you two reasons why. Okay, see the side A, side B? That's in the dark area of the city skyline. On the regular waterfronts, it's in the sky. Also, the runout groove on that is very large. I've seen those bootlegs before. The regular waterfront runout grooves are about an inch on each side. That one has a thin one and a fat one on the other side.
You're right. That's exactly what it does.
Yeah.
Interesting. Who would do this? It's a really well made.
Well, you know what those original waterfronts go for these days? I mean, you know, $500-$600.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, okay. $20 in Chile. Not so bad.
That's all right. Yeah.
What's funny is I wonder what factory would have done this because they would have had to cut it from the CD because it's a fresh cut, obviously, because the runout grooves are different. The acetate was different. It's possible that it actually sounds good. Not that I will ever play it.
Well, now you can A-B it against the reissue and really kind of see the difference there.
Where do you think it came out of? The Far East?
No idea. No idea.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
It's got to be bootleg. One of the most well-made bootlegs or pirates I've seen. Right?
Unfortunately there, yeah. You paid $20 and... That's about what it's worth.
Well, you know what? I'm not too worried because I have a test pressing of bleach. And I know that that one's authentic. So let me show you a couple of things that have come out recently. Please. That this was a band called 10 Minute Warning. This was from 1984 in Seattle. It was never released. And I got a chance to mix this down. And it just came out on CZ Records just a couple months ago. This is like a sort of a historical pre-grunge Seattle band.
Okay.
You mentioned my solo record that I'm pretty happy with.
Yep.
This is a record I did for Chris Novoselic actually last year, a couple years ago. It's called Butterfly Launches from Sparpole. And it's basically fingerstyle acoustic guitar. He's become very, very adept at this sort of John Fahey kind of thing. And a friend of his named Robert Michael Pyle doing sort of a spoken word thing on top of this acoustic background. And it's a very much of a... It's better than it sounds, you know. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an amazing record. And then this, which just came out, this is a band that I've been in for a few years called Sky Cries Mary. There's 300 copies of this vinyl. This was a record we made that came out in March of 2020. What could go wrong? You know,
you guys caused it. No,
we caused it. Apparently, obviously we caused the whole thing, but you know, but anyway, we finally got vinyl of it just a month ago. And since then we've made another album, which is called, Wandering in the Vastness. This literally just came out a few weeks ago, and vinyl for that has also, it's in. I should be getting them in a week. So it's kind of interesting. We made two albums essentially during a period when everybody was dead in the water. And we've got vinyl. It's like 300 copies of each. It won't be a lot.
But, it's actually being delivered now. So you put it in like last year. So you'll actually be able to have it ready to ship and, you know, pretty quick.
Yeah. Apparently the press, the record company, which is a small prog label called Trail Records in New York, they've got the vinyl copies. So, you know, they'll go pretty quick, but okay. It's kind of fun. I haven't listened to it yet. You know, I've been too busy. They tell me it sounds good. I'm crossing my fingers.
You'll be the judge of that.
Yeah.
I'll put links to all these in this episode page. What do you think the future is for vinyl?
I don't know, you know, because I thought a few years ago, I thought it was just going to be a fad because again, I thought, well, people aren't even listening to these, you know, they're pulling the download card and listening on their, you know, and you can't listen to it in a car. You can't listen to it on your phone. So how are most people listening to music these days? And for that matter, where are they getting their turntables from? Mm-hmm. And where are they getting their needles from? So I'm still a little slightly puzzled about vinyl, but apparently it's outselling CDs right now. Mm-hmm. It's a pity because it's very expensive to ship. You know, postage is not getting cheaper. It's kind of a pain in the ass, but, and you know, it takes months to make it, but, you know, if you'd asked me a few years ago if it would be outselling CDs, I would have laughed at you. So, you know, who knows? I'm kind of delighted because I like seeing real cover art. You know, it's nice to hold it in your hand.
At any point in the last 25 years, did you almost take all your records to the dump?
Never.
Okay.
Absolutely not. That's not happening.
Okay. Thanks again, Jack, for coming on the Vinyl Guide. I know you got to run here. Sky Cries Mary. I'll put the links in the episode page as well as for your solo album, Jack and Dino, Set Myself on Fire. There's red copies. There's black copies. There's autograph copies. Make sure to check that out, everyone. I've been having it on my iPhone. I don't have my physical copy yet, but it's something I do want to hear pumping out on my big speakers. Jack, I do want to have you back on the show at some point, and we'll do another deep dive. But again, thank you so much for coming on and talking records with us.
Okay, I hope that was useful for you, and I gave you some useful trivia.
Oh, yeah. Look, it's good. Look, these sort of conversations are always great. We're record nerds, but we're also in our cars and going on walks, and that's exactly what this podcast is for. So it just keeps the conversation going.
Excellent.
All right, there we go. Thanks, Jack, for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide. Again, don't forget there's an extended version of this interview up at patreon.com/vinylguide. Go up there, support the show, enjoy the extras, and of course, make sure to pick up a copy of Jack's album, Setting Myself on Fire, vinyl available at capacitorrecords.com. And I've also included some links in this episode page for all the other albums he mentioned. That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them on your Facebook page, tweet them out on Twitter, or you could even show your friends how to subscribe to The Vinyl Guide podcast on their smartphones. Just helping them work it out for a minute or two can give them hours and days of pleasure. And I don't mean that to sound kinky or weird, but it will, and you'll be a better person for it. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.